So hello and welcome to the ABCs of Green Politics, a podcast which is part of the Left Bloc Political Education Project. I'm Linda Sullivan and I'll be your host for this episode. So today we've arrived at T, and T is for transformation. So how do we transform our society into the one that's just, equal, ecologically and socially thriving? And to help me wade through that, I'm delighted to welcome Sean Farron. So Sean gave a great talk a few weekends ago and in Skullclosh Clee, Left Bloc's Political Education Weekend on Inishowen. Sean's talk was entitled No United Ireland on a Dead Planet. So that talk, along with the other great talks, are due to come out on Left Bloc podcasts and videos soon, so keep an ear out for those. So Sean, could you tell me a wee bit about your background and what you're currently working on at the minute?
Yeah, sure. So I'm currently working in the Centre for Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity in University of Surrey. Was based in Guildford, and only after finishing a PhD in Queen's, and before that I was a policy officer, so worked in politics, sort of economic and climate policy and that for a few years, and then sort of broader environmental activism and that. So yeah, certainly all within the bounds of this.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, so just to jump in then, so why do we need to transform? Bit of an obvious question, but yeah, so what's the problem? Is there a problem?
Yeah, of course. I think in a word, the problem is unsustainability, isn't it? That's my background's economics, but of course it ranges into politics and into society and that. And that there's just a real sense, and the evidence would say this as well, that the economic system and political system is fundamentally unsustainable, not just in ecological terms, but also in that the outcomes that it's producing for people aren't working anymore. You know, so democracies are less democratic. Societies aren't producing the same outcomes, they're creating inequality, less well-being, and so on. So I think that just the idea of transformation from post-growth or from sort of radical green perspectives are that there is a whole system change needed. And there's probably, with the word transition, even though it's, you know, there's more radical understandings of just transition, which the audience might be familiar with. I mean, it's very easy to greenwash, isn't it? It just sort of gives this idea that, right, there's managerial solutions to sort of high carbon sectors of the economy. We can take people out of coal plants and, you know, create a few pension schemes and buy off workers and so on. And we retain the structures that create the unsustainability, that have created extractivism and, you know, poor well-being for people, vast inequality, disempowerment of communities and all these things. So I think it's just a greater call for a broader transformation of the economy away from extractive and exploitative capitalism and towards something that really produces, really empowers people, workers, communities, and sort of completely, you know, reshapes the relationship between the economy and the earth. I think that's where the likes of your post-growth and your degrowth policies and ideas and theories and stuff come in. And I think that's where the movement is sort of heading and sort of trying to put the meat in the bones in that way. But yeah, that's, I think, the need to transform. You know, and I suppose in ecological terms, we don't need to maybe rehearse this with the audience, but like, it's clear probably for listeners of this podcast what that is. We're facing ecological crisis and climate catastrophe. And that's not just with carbon emissions, it's with everything. It's with, you know, our food system, it's land use, it's biodiversity extinction. It's a poly crisis, as we say. So yeah, transfer, you know, small tweaks around the edges and a few little policy changes aren't going to solve that. And there needs to be a system transformation. That's a big ask, but that's what's required.
Yeah. So with, like, you touched on there, like, so it's the term transition has been, like, now co-opted, like, by industry, by government, by capitalism, you know. So it's like, you know, the green transition really means a transition from capitalism to green capitalism, you know. So, and it's keeping the same system but just switching the fuel.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and so that only, as you were talking about, it's not just the climate crisis. There's all these other crises. You know, if we fix the climate crisis just by lowering our carbon emissions, like, we're still on a road to devastation, you know, through extinction, through system collapse, through the collapse of our food systems, through collapse of our energy system. So I suppose, yeah, that term transformation then is more all-encompassing, and yeah, tackles the root cause of the problem, which is capitalism.
Definitely. And it brings in those more like radical perspectives as well. I think that there was a great paper, I think it was from the UN Sustainable Development. It's not an agency, but that branch of the UN and some research that was done there, but basically mapping out in a visual sort of sense the different just transitions, right? So people may be more familiar with that term, but how, where they have happened and what the actual results of those have been. So, moving away from, say, coal mines and the coal industry in Germany or the coal industry in Spain. What has actually happened? Are they just sort of changing those sectors? Have you thrown people out of work? Have you just given them sort of new jobs in equally exploitative sectors? Do their wages increase? Do they get a greater share of the value they produce? This kind of thing. Or does it actually result in a proper transition away from the system that created that? So that was a helpful resource for me in sort of explaining that and giving sort of tangible examples. Now, I suppose for green thinkers and eco-socialists like ourselves, but it's not it's none of them are reaching the ambition where we'd wanted to be, but it was an interesting sort of approach to that.
Yeah, and have you? You probably have read the book "Less Is More" by Jason Hickel. Yeah, that was really great for me. Just it was quite an accessible read, But yeah, just talking about like the I suppose the I suppose like breaking down that notion that yeah, degrowth is like all about scarcity. It's all about taking away our comforts and our like or even like our needs, so our needs won't even be met, So what do you say to that narrative, that's trying to scare us into the change, really?
Yeah, of course. First thing is that he's obviously a leading degrowth thinker, and he's exceptional in this regard. And as you say, very accessible. So, he tries not to be as wonky as possible, which is very difficult when you're talking about economics, things like that. But yeah, I mean, just to define it first, I think degrowth generally, I think the idea is just that the size and scale of the global economy, and specifically the sort of overdeveloped north, the capitalist economies, are far too big. They consume too much. They produce too much. And they've exceeded what ecologists would now call our planetary boundaries. And that's not just as we're talking about earlier, your carbon emissions, but it's everything. It's the material that we use, and it's the ability of the Earth to absorb the waste that we produce, and so on. And I think there's the hope on the right and within some on the left that we can actually continue to grow, and so we can address scarcity. And this is, I think, increasingly a problem among socialists. We can address scarcity and poverty where it exists by keeping to grow the economy, and they don't want to engage with that debate. But the evidence shows that we're not that can't happen. We can't reduce emissions and our material consumption and so on at the rate that we need to, sufficiently fast, and also remain within our planetary boundaries. So that's what the evidence would point to. So that's the background. I think within that, then we have to understand, well, what is the actual, what are the relations of production? What is the nature of the economy that's producing this unsustainability? And it's capitalism. So capitalism relies upon scarcity. If we think about it, and this is the sort of paradox of degrowth, we're outside of our planetary boundaries in the global north. Yet when we look at our societies, there's scarcity everywhere of the things that we actually need. There's not enough public housing. The health service in the north, for example, I'm always going to gravitate towards Irish examples here, but the health service in the north it's on its knees. We haven't got enough renewable energy yet. These are all sectors that need to grow. So there is scarcity there. That's because capitalism doesn't produce for that. It produces for what will create a profit, the exchange value versus what we actually need, what has a social use. And it also relies on scarcity because once it has a monopoly over these things, then it can charge for them. It can, the sort of rentier capitalist system that your community wealth building people would critique. So degrowth isn't just about, degrowing everything. It's about degrowing the things that we don't need, that, affect our well-being negatively, that bring us outside these planetary boundaries. And it's about meeting social need within that sort of ecological envelope. So it is a more sophisticated thing than just, paring everything down massively reducing consumption for its own sake. That needs to happen, but we need to increase consumption of things that make us happy and that improve our health and our well-being. So now that's the challenge, isn't it? Because the right can say, I haven't seen anyone who's right wing accept the planetary boundaries framework. But these they might at some stage say, okay, yeah, that's a good idea, right? So what we need is austerity, and the working class are going to pay for it. So I think degrowth is in a position where it can sort of combat those ideas, you know.
Do you think there should be a different term? Do you think like degrowth is too like scary for people, or has been promoted as something different than it actually is? So do you think the term could change, or do you think like it's grand?
I think I heard Jason Hickel on another great podcast, a Green podcast, the Green New Deal podcast that's run by, I think, the New Economy Foundation. And I think he essentially came to the point where, now it wasn't him that came up with this word. I think it comes from the French word, décroissance. So essentially scaling back production and the good life and well-being and so on. But yeah, the English translation doesn't sound just as sexy. And it is a problem because it sounds like recession to people. It sounds like, and recession sounds like austerity. It sounds like a collapse in living standards. So I think if they could have it all back in the sort of branding war, then yeah, degrowth might not be the terminology you would use. And that's why post-growth and these things are softer. But then post-growth can also sort of welcome in your sort of these reformist type attitudes that we're sort of criticizing in this episode. That, you know, we can really still grow, we can have green growth, and we can have all these sort of things. So you can sort of see that start to be co-opted as well. So, you know, the language is an issue, but I think at the sort of thin end of the wedge, maybe to get towards those more radical degrowth perspectives, is like the well-being economy. You know, I don't think the economy and what we're producing and consuming at the minute, people know that they're, even though as the economy grows, their well-being and their living standards haven't improved. And for example, in the north, the data would bear this out. So we only have, say, well-being data back to 2011, but people aren't any happier since then. And the economy's grown every year, bar COVID. So, you know, I think, yeah, there's other means of getting at this, but I think the sort of the radical edge of degrowth is still important. Yeah, and it's an explicitly eco-socialist paradigm for the global north.
Yeah, so I suppose no matter what term you use, it'll be co-opted, or they'll try to co-opt it, you know, and take its force away from it. So I suppose it's just like stand strong in your narrative, and it's like actually, you know, what challenging the simplicity of the criticisms, you know. And so I suppose, like, looking at the well-being economy, what would it look like then? What are all the elements of a well-being economy?
Yeah, so again, it's back to this question about like, what do we not have now that we need, and what does the evidence say makes us happy? And I think there's this idea, it's the sort of fundament of neoclassical economics. I'm always gravitating towards, so stop me from boring people, but always gravitating towards the economic perspective here. But this idea within the neoclassical ideas and your neoliberal, that if we buy something, we've decided that was a good thing to do, and we've decided it in the free market with all the information available to us, ergo it's made us happy and it was a good thing to do. But that isn't the case, and beyond a certain threshold of actually consuming things, there's no evidence that it actually improves people's well-being. And people probably know this as well. If you just buy, I don't know, more crap, more vapes, more phone covers, all the things that our high streets are littered with now, it clearly doesn't improve our life expectancy or make us more connected to our families or our communities and these sorts of things. So a well-being economy needs what I think post-growth economists would say is qualitative growth, not just growth in material and consumption of things, but in happiness and in the services that we need, and in, as I say, a connection to nature and to our communities and that. And the fundamentals of that then are like universal basic services, and trying to take as much of the sort of service provision and goods provision of these very basic needs, necessities, need satisfaction out of the market where people can make a profit and exploit us over it, and into the hands of communities and into the hands of the state, and where possible into the hands of nature, so that we have nature-based solutions and services and so on. And I think that's what the well-being economy is based on, cure and repair. It's about, I think that's also another language that would come from, say, the cusp end of things where I'm working, and Tim Jackson and so on. This idea that we should have a cure economy where people doing service work, not producing things that we don't need, because it, beyond a certain point, we're only consuming for the benefit of those who own the means of production. But you're spending more time, say, restoring nature and caring for relatives and repairing things so that we're not throwing them away and damaging the environment. And these sort of this service-based employment, the care and repair type employment, that is also the sort of, that's the answer on the labor side. And yeah, I think it's a whole host of those things, but then you also need to sort of change the values. I mean, what's this all about? If we're still competing against each other to get ahead, and you know, that sort of the capitalist competition impulse, which defines the economy that we have today, that also won't make us any happier because we have status competition and so on. So yeah, I think the well-being economy is wee bits of all of those.
Yeah. So the idea that human nature is competitive, you know, that we are naturally competitors with each other. So it's like a zero-sum game. But you know, there's many examples in nature that shows that we're actually cooperative at heart. And that we're better off cooperating. And I suppose then just a concrete example of how that plays out, you know, it's like the private car model that we have all been funneled into in our society has been, or the infrastructure of our society has been created around it. So, you know, you feel guilty jumping in your car, but also there's very little infrastructure in terms of public transport for you to easily leave the car behind, you know. So and then in this, you know, so-called green transition, it's just like change all those petrol cars and diesel cars to like electric cars, which that framework of individuality and, you know, your own wee world, and you know, you're still competing with everybody else. But if we had like a really solid, accessible, affordable, preferably free public transport system, or even the sharing of cars, you know, there's really good models elsewhere where like a shared car system or like a rental car, but accessible, you know.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say that car model kind of like encapsulates the whole like capitalist mindset, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. And like you can conceivably see a world, if not a probable world, where like electric cars just become the new status competition, because we're still, you know, driven by these impulses. We're always competing in consumerism, and I suppose the growth economy relies on that. Even when people don't have the money, then you go into debt to do it. And that sort of financialization of the economy since the 1980s, that's a big part of that as well. Just keep consuming and eventually it'll make you happy. And so you say, I think like that concept in economics was known as homo economicus. And when economists think of the market and all these things, they imagine that the agent that takes part in these is a man. He's always perfectly rational, always makes decisions that are within his perfect interest, all this sort of stuff. And we obviously know that doesn't happen. People make decisions based on, I don't know, impulse, out of anger, out of whatever it might be. And there's a great quote from John Ruskin. He says, listen, I'm not interested in that study of economics. I'm sort of as interested as I might be in a study of gymnastics. That assumes people have no skeletons.
Yeah. But also we are influenced by advertising, you know, that like all pervasive manipulative advertising. So if that, like if there were restrictions or even like, especially in certain places, like you know, outside schools, or like advertising is like especially directed to children. You know, just one example, but it's just like, you know, there needs to be strong restrictions on advertising, and places where it just simply can't be.
Yeah, big priority for degrowth, advertising, fossil fuels, defense, these types of things, and people would point towards that. That's certainly something we don't need. That's a terrible use of resources.
Yeah, and then sponsorship, I suppose, is a big part of that too, like fossil fuel companies and banks, fossil fuel funders are like throwing millions into cleaning their image through sponsoring like charities that need the money, really, or you know, institutions, or you know, so it's like Yeah, how do you restrict that? And you're not blaming the people who receive the money who need it, because our system is broken and our services aren't funded properly, but also, calling out that greenwashing. Yeah, an example recently is W5, like Citibank sponsors a climate change exhibition aimed at children in
Oh my
W5, like
God.
a crazy example of greenwashing, that's just one.
Not crazy.
And so yeah, jumping then into something else you touched on, like you mentioned community wealth building. Could you talk a wee bit about that and explain what it is?
Yeah, of course. Community wealth building, I mean, it's been about, I suppose, is an idea for decades. Originally came from the United States, but has been pioneered in Britain, in Preston, and these places, and likes a trademark. And your colleagues, Linda, I mean, definitely the drivers of it here in Ireland. Essentially, this idea that neoliberal capitalism, it's these huge corporations that are based upon extracting income and sort of the exploitation of labor and of communities by extracting income and wealth from those communities. Pissing that away into shareholders' pockets, and it's not retained in communities. So when people, are employed by those large corporations, paid terrible wages, the profits that are made there aren't recirculated back into communities. They're brought elsewhere. They're brought to the sort of financial sector, to shareholders in the States or into bank accounts elsewhere in the world, the Cayman Islands, whatever it might be. And these communities who produce the labor or produce the value part in these areas are the ones that don't get to keep it and are always left worse off. So this the essential idea is, well, what about worker-owned cooperatives? What about using public institutions and publicly owned entities and enterprises in these areas to make sure that when we consume within our communities, that income, that sort of that wealth is circulated and it is retained there. So that, and this was seen as a way to, where the left couldn't take power in, say, the United States or certainly in Britain in the last 20 years and more. Well, how do we actually then take sort of radical social action for local economies? And community wealth building was that kind of idea. And it certainly links to degrowth and post-growth, because when this is based on, I think, some great work. It's now theory. It would be good to see some sort of examples to bear this out. But Georges Kallas, he's a Greek degrowth economist, will be very prominent within that sort of sphere. Basically, worker-owned and community-owned enterprises don't compete in the same way that, say, privately owned enterprises and entities do. They're not driven by the same sort of competitive impulse. They sort of the idea of community wealth building is that, right, you spot a gap in your community. What's not being provided? What can we provide then? How do we get local unemployed people to provide that? And how can we create an entity that then provides that good or service to us? And you're meeting social needs. You're not competing for a profit, and you're not trying to force down wages to create a higher profit. And that takes away the growth imperative, right? So, like, you're not always trying to maximize profit for more investments to get more profit for more investments, and that is essentially the growth cycle. So, community wealth building is a big part to play in that, particularly for local economies and rural economies, and that is a big issue in Ireland as well. It's a big part to play. As part of that sort of degrowth puzzle, it's a sort of meso level or local level solution. And the macro, obviously, there's much more sort of bigger things that we can do there. We were talking about universal basic services, for example, but community wealth building is a big part of that.
Yeah, and there's some great podcasts by Trademark on community wealth building. And I
Certainly.
suppose then, yeah, taking that well, I suppose the cooperative model then, and like worker owned, worker controlled workspaces, and also like unionized workspaces. So like they're hugely important in the future or the economy we want.
And that's the democratized shift. Like, once you sort of have that sort of worker-owned and community-owned enterprise, it's back to that question of, we are well beyond our planetary boundaries. So the things that we need to produce need to actually make us happier. They need to meet social need, address poverty, address, homelessness, and so on. And our resources right now aren't being used in anywhere near the sort of efficient manner that they need to be able to address those, because that's capitalism's raison d'etre. So if you have democratic control over these things, which is a fundamental component of degrowth. And it gets back to that question earlier about how do you prevent this being co-opted by the right, you know, and mass austerity and so on. Once you have that sort of democratic ownership, well, yeah, you will address the things that we need to provide, and people will be able to see that. Communities organized around you know, economic entities can also bind communities and make decisions in their own interests, as opposed to just leaving everyone to the mercy of the market, which is, I suppose, where we are now, you know.
Yeah, and then yeah, it reminds me as well of the problem with renewable energy, because it's not community owned, it's not worker owned, you know. So it's like it's big wind, it's you know, it's huge solar farms owned by large corporations, and communities see that and they don't see a benefit for themselves, because there isn't really, the energy doesn't come to them. You know, they're often in the wrong place, like, you know, windmills on bogs, and so it's like it's corrupting a solution in a way. You know, renewable mm-hmm. energy is a solution, but the way it's been done, you know, funneled into this profit making model, it's been corrupted, and it only further exploits the marginalized, you know, rural communities, and, you know, places, further destroys ecosystems, you know. So renewable yep. energy becomes then part of the problem.
Yeah, and it's not a perfect example of, I think you had a you know, back to this sort of central question we're talking about the difference between transformation and transition. You had a great phrase earlier about, okay, we should keep all the structures that just keep creating inequality and biodiversity loss and all of the extraction and exploitation that exists at the moment, but we just change the energy input. And so instead of us relying on fossil fuel imports from fossil fuel giants, the scum of the earth, we are relying on, you know, as you said, Danish or Scottish energy giants to be able to provide this at scale for profit, and using public energy, public resources, pardon, to sort of subsidize that, as opposed to subsidizing, you know, as you say, community-owned energy. And that is the kind of structural change we're talking about here. Do you just change the input into the system and that greens it a little bit and reduces our carbon emissions? Or do you fundamentally, you know, change the structures of exploitation and produce the inequality and disempowerment that leaves communities isolated and worse off?
Yeah. So we talked about democratizing the economy. So what about democratizing our politics? How can that be done?
That's really good questions. So, but like, I mean, there's this I think there's a lot of despondency, and probably for good reason, when we look at sort of our liberal democratic systems at the moment, how corrupted they are by corporate influence, how immobile and not agile they are enough to address the sort of speed and haste of climate crisis. That doesn't necessarily mean that we need this overarching totalitarian state that can mobilize resources. That's not the solution either. But yeah, there's a fundamental problem with sort of parliamentarianism and these bourgeois parliaments that we're relying on to be able to address this crisis, because right now they've patently failed. We'll take the North as an example, whatever about the dysfunctionality of the state at its heart, and the fact that we haven't had a government in half the times of the Good Friday, since the Good Friday Agreement. The one time they do pass a climate act last year, it was at the last hurdle, contaminated by corporate influence. That's always going to be there, because there's just that disconnect between, you know, elected representatives, even those who have in smaller economies or democracies like ours. You know, there's that sort of smaller gap between parliamentarians and the ground. That disconnect still exists. So like the alternatives, citizens' assemblies, these types of things, but I think it goes deeper, and it's back to some of the issues and ideas we're talking around community wealth building, like economic democracy being a component of real political democracy. If we can actually manage the resources ourselves in democratic ways, then we're not reliant on passing bills and you know, sort of corporate lobbying and so on to be able to do that from above, this sort of grassroots economic democracy filtering through into political life. So I think the likes of citizens' assemblies have been successful here in driving social change, but they're not a panacea. I hate that word, but they're not. Mm-hmm. And I think then it's a broader question, isn't it? It is linked into a more grassroots thing, and of course I'm looking at it the economic angle, but I mean that's part of it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so I suppose the state of of the state,
Yep.
the state of governments now is just a prop up capitalism, really, because capitalism wouldn't continue if states didn't do that. They talk about free market, but without all these the current state of capitalism, without all these bailouts or tax breaks and whatever else, like red carpet they roll out for corporations, like capitalism would be dead if states have don't prop it up, so I suppose that's the state's main role now. So how can we transform that? And as you say, it starts locally, it starts in communities, starts in workplaces, and it's building out from there. It's like, taking back our power, and making democratic decisions of in every aspect of our lives,
And that piece around taking back power and all, I think that's where the likes of direct action comes in, because I think it needs a shock to the system. We don't see we see, I mean, your work and our comrades' work across the island, and in terms of direct action and the sparrings and so on. I mean, this is this type of stuff we need, and I think it creates flashpoints around which the sort of established order has to now decide, well, what side are you on? Frequently, they choose the wrong side, as we know, but. Yeah, I think that it needs to be shook out of its slumber. Maybe it's not a slumber, it's how the sort of political system has designed itself to manage the affairs of capital and so on. But yeah, I think that's another sort of influx or injection of democracy that we need. It's more direct action and more people taking ethical democratic stands outside of the sort of parliamentary space to demand action. Because I mean, at the pace we're going, never mind the capacity of the state in Ireland and certainly in the north to be able to address these, even if every parliamentarian was a green eco-socialist, we need more, we need faster action. And I think that's where some of that urgency can come from.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose it's like we need to be building the alternatives and living the alternatives now, but we also need to continue to hold back the onslaught, of the current system and support communities on the front line, such as you mentioned, the Sparrows, and also communities across across the island who are also facing like mining threats, but also destruction of the environment. And like, it was great to see the LNG and the Shannon
Oh, excellent.
directed, and that was based on a very long fight by activists, including direct actions, so direct action can work, like activism can work, and it needs to, like, we need to have like brave activism alongside like holding back the bad shit, as well as growing the good stuff,
It's that sort of dual bit, and I might take an opportunity to plug. I'm allowed to do this cross podcasting, but Callum McGeown, is it Love, Rage, and Revolution? I think him and Louise Taylor done a few podcasts in Queens and that sort of second series. I'm sure people can look it up, but yeah, look, I mean, just answering this fundamental question about political action in a time of crisis and what does that look like, and like the likes of Just Stop Oil and all these sort of things. I'm not entirely convinced of the methods. I'm not entirely convinced of, in that case, of even the ask that, well, I mean, it's obviously a good ask, and campaigns need to be targeted towards a very specific thing. You can't block the roads and demand an end to climate change. It needs to be targeted. But I think there's a broader thing that's happening around Just Stop Oil that isn't just addressed towards a policy thing. It's about that kind of shaking people and saying, this is what anger looks like, and trying. And I think, it's not about influencing 60% of the population to vote for you at the ballot box. It's about making maybe 2, 3, 5% of the population angry enough about the sort of the state of the system and how it treats protesters demanding a livable planet, to be able to join them. And I think that model might work. And that's another sort of element of democratization, you know.
Yeah, I suppose it's like there's not one thing that will work, it's
Absolutely.
management. It's like, a thousand cracks, the crack capitalism, it's
Yeah.
like, not everyone can afford to put themselves forward for arrest, and that's been a big criticism of Extinction Rebellion and other direct action groups. But it's like having that like wide array of activism, so it's like activism is organizing at town hall. You know, activism is going speaking to your neighbours. Activism is stopping diggers. Like, activism is, you know, doing a podcast. Or listening to a podcast, you know.
I know, I don't know if I should say this, but you make a very, very good point about, you know, fines, not everyone being able to do that. And I sort of tinkered with Just Stop Oil and contact and see what the crack was. And the guy says to me, this is pulling back the curtain a wee bit, as I say, and he sort of says, you know, well, listen, it's only a custodial sort of offence. It's not a major criminal thing. You know, it's just a fine of a few hundred pounds. Don't worry about it. And I'm like, right, so only a few hundred pounds. Okay, I'll be able to throw that together. That's mass action, isn't it? I know, again, that is what it is. That's the state's response, isn't it? So you can't blame people that way, but you're right. Like, I just thought that sort of mindset was just like, it's just not that easy, big lad.
Yeah, exactly. And the, you know, the laws coming in to make it even more of a risk to be an activist, you know, are crazy, you know. So it is scary. And yeah, acknowledging that not everyone can, but then also, it's not in solidarity with those that do too, you know. Okay, good stuff. We'll end there. I think we've covered a good bit. Thanks a million for joining us.
Of course.
Yeah, and thanks to your listeners, of course. Check out the other Left Block podcasts and support if you can on Patreon. And also, keep an eye out for further episodes of ABC's Green Politics. All right, for Amila Mayagas, slán.